These are the top stories. A group of countries, including Iran, Russia, and China, are reportedly pushing to create a coalition at the UN to counter the use or threat of force and unilateral sanctions. Heavily armed Israeli soldiers detained five Palestinian children after they were confronted by the settlers in the occupied West Bank. Also this hour, official data shows Britain's economy shrank by 2.9% in January following fresh coronavirus lockdowns. A group of 16 countries, including Iran, Russia, and China, are reportedly seeking support for a coalition that counters the use or threat of force and unilateral sanctions. According to Reuters, the coalition is called the quote-unquote Group of Friends in Defense of the Charter of the UN. Syria, North Korea, Venezuela, and Cuba are among the other member states of the coalition. A concept note for the group says unprecedented attacks against multilateralism are threatening global peace and security. The concept adds that the imposition of coercive measures and withdrawal from global agreements and institutions are signs of growing unilateralism. A former U.S. administration was internationally criticized for its unilateral and isolationist policies and approaches. Its successor has pledged to reverse course, but has yet to deliver. Iran's ambassador to the UN says sanctions are inhumane and illegal measures which have consequences similar to those of terrorism and war crimes. Majid Takht Ravanchi said consequences of sanctions are as brutal and criminal as those of terror and war crimes. Made the comments at a UN Security Council meeting on hunger and famine in conflicts. Iran's envoy said sanctions are one of the main causes of creating food insecurity. Takht Ravanchi also spoke about U.S. sanctions on Iran. He said the measures have hindered Iran's access to food, medicine, and medical equipment amid the pandemic. It also called for the immediate lifting of the ongoing siege on Yemen and the Gaza Strip. Welcome to this hour's news review. Israeli forces have detained five Palestinian children while they were gathering wild vegetables in the occupied West Bank. Israeli rights group Beit Salem released a video of the arrest in the Hebron Hills, that is in the southern West Bank. Israeli soldiers dragged the children away by force after they were confronted by two settlers. The Palestinian children were held for about 5 hours. Their ages range from 8 to 13. The two oldest and the four old enough to face charges were ordered to return next week for more questioning. According to Defense for Children International, Israel each year prosecutes hundreds of Palestinian children in military courts. A Palestinian rights group says 140 Palestinian children are currently in Israeli jails. I'll be discussing this with guests who have kindly given their time for us this hour. Mona Kandil, our correspondent in Ramallah, as well as Mazin Qomsiyeh. He's a Palestinian scientist and author who joins us via Skype out of Beit Lehem. Thank you both. I'm going to begin with perhaps the latest on that and what has that story entailed for the children that were arrested. And I'm going to hand you over to Mona for that. Mona?
The Israeli military forces claim that those five children entered to the illegal Israeli settlement of Havat Moan. However, let's make it clear that this illegal settlement was built on Palestinian land, lands from the village of Yatta, and those Palestinians were there, as you had mentioned, picking some wild vegetables. Then the settlers came out and tried to terrify them. However, the Israeli forces came instead of defending or protecting those young children from the Israeli settlers. They arrested them, saying that they did something against Israel. Though it's not the first time Palestinian children are being being arrested. Hundreds of them are being detained each year. According to a Palestinian report, in 2020, more than 1,000 Palestinian children was detained by the Israeli forces. In February alone, over 60 Palestinian children were detained by the Israeli soldiers. And we are speaking about less children at the age of 8 and 7 years old. However, the interrogation with those five Palestinian children would continue, and they might be arrested for months or even under the illegal so-called administrative detention without clear charges against them, in order to keep them behind bars and to terrify other children by sending a message to their families that this would be the destiny of your children if you will not control them or prevent them from taking part in any anti-Israel activities, or even from being very close to the illegal settlements.
Mazin Ghamsia in Beit Lehem, why don't you share with us what you think about this recent incident?
Well, this is a classic Israeli terrorism. This is a state that has been built on terrorism, and terrorizing little children is all that it has been able to do recently, is terrorize people out of their lands. Its intention from the beginning has been to remove people from the land. These children were gathering wild plants in their own land, in their own land. They were not even close to this illegal outpost. But the settlers don't want these children gathering wild plants. They don't want them anywhere near, because these illegal colonial settlers, who by international law are considered war crimes to settle on somebody else's land, these war criminals attempted to chase the children away, and they did, and the children ran away from them. They ran away from them, leaving behind their buckets with the wild plants. The settlers actually stole the wild plants that the children collected and went to their homes. The children were not a threat to anybody. They were collecting wild plants. And this is by witness, not just of Palestinians present at the scene, but of the Israelis present at the scene, Israeli peace activists. And then the settlers, the colonial illegal settlers, went and brought the army and told them there were children who came into our compound, basically lying about it, saying they came into their compound, and they told the soldiers to go arrest them. And the soldiers, obviously, like the settlers, they are colonial settlers, so they went and obeyed the settlers and went and arrested the children from their homes. This is what happened. And the children, as pointed out in the news reports, are five children, ages from 8 to 12. The two children who are 12 year old are going to be charged, probably, based on the lies of the settlers, because Israel can actually charge children as young as 12 years old, not younger than 12. So the two have been summoned for another hearing in a week from today. This is so outrageous. This is so ridiculous. It goes even beyond my ability to describe the sheer, as I say in Yiddish, chutzpah of it, that you arrest children who are picking wild plants instead of arresting the people who stole the wild plants they collected. This is the horrible thing about it.
Mm-hmm. Mona, of course, Mr. Ghamsia just also pointed out, and, you know, basically, you know, took the question from my mouth, you know, about the fate of the children, especially the older ones that I said in my report are going to be hurt, if that's the chance or that's the word, in military courts. You know, one would think that what might become of those children. Do you have any idea, and perhaps, you know, in what way is it going to impact their peers, other children, and, you know, the families of those children?
The the journey of pain starts from the minute the Israeli forces arrest Palestinians. And even if they are children, they will not differ from elderly Palestinians. They will be beaten, attacked all the way from the area they were arrested to the interrogation centers. Then the journey of pain will continue. They will be left without food and without water for several hours and sometimes days, not even allowing any of the family members to meet them or their lawyers. And this is against the law, of course. However, following the interrogation, they might keep them behind bars for several months under the so-called administrative detention. However, Palestinian children over the age of 12 years, they will be prosecuted in Israeli military courts like elderly Palestinians, and they can receive let's say, a long term of detention for years. For example, this would be the case and their fate, unfortunately.
Mr. Gomsia, what do you think is going to become of the children? Because I'm pretty sure that a lot of people now worry about their fate, given your experience and what you've heard of cases similar like these in the past.
I mean, there's an Israeli lawyer, Gabi Lasky, who's working on the case of these children. I think the damage is already done, basically. The psychology of these children is damaged. And I think it's really harmful for us not to think about taking Israel to international courts on such crimes. These are crimes against humanity. This is terrorism. I don't care if they eventually charge them after a week after they go investigate them. They ask them to come back to the court, whether they levy charges against them for based on the lies of the settlers or they don't levy charges against them. It's irrelevant, in my humble opinion. Israel has already jailed, as pointed out by Muna, many, many dozens of Palestinian children over the past year, 1,000 or so, and they have really, really damaged our lives, our children's lives. More than half the population of our people are children, and they suffer tremendously under this colonial racist regime, terrorizing regime, basically. And enough is enough. I think Israeli soldiers and officials, including their government, should be taken to task and stop giving impunity to basically child molesters. This is what I would call them, child molesters. They are terrorists, and they need to be held accountable.
Okay, thank you very much, both of you, for your time. Mona Kandil, correspondent in Ramallah, as well as Mr. Mazin Omsiye, Palestinian scientist and author out of Beit Lehem. I appreciate your time. Welcome back. Official data shows Britain's economy shrank by 2.9% in January as the country re-entered coronavirus lockdown. The Office for National Statistics said gross domestic product hit reverse after 1.2% growth in December. That happened as government COVID restrictions reduced economic activity. The pandemic took a heavy toll on Britain's economy last year when it collapsed at us by 10%. That was the worst performance of the British economy in over three centuries. Meanwhile, the latest data by the Office for National Statistics shows a record decline in exports to the EU. The exports slumped by 41% in January after the UK finalized its divorce from the bloc. Thailand says it has delayed the use of AstraZeneca's COVID vaccine over safety concerns. The program was due to start on Friday, but the Thai government delayed it after reports of blood clots in some vaccinated people in Europe. The Asian nation is the first country outside Europe to suspend the use of the AstraZeneca shot. Denmark, Norway, and Iceland have already suspended their vaccination programs using the shot. AstraZeneca says it has found no evidence of an increased risk of formation of blood clots in safety data of more than 10 million records. UN Chief Antonio Guterres has blasted what he called many examples of vaccine nationalism and hoarding during the pandemic. Guterres also criticized side deals with COVID vaccine producers that undermine access to all people in the world. A UN chief said the global vaccination campaign represents the greatest moral test of our times. Made the comments in a statement marking 1 year since the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic. Guterres promised that the UN will keep pressing for affordable vaccines available for everyone on the planet. A new study by an anti-poverty group says the world's richest countries are on course to receive 1 billion more doses than their citizens need. The United States has just approved its first major COVID-related economic package since the CARES Act was passed in March of 2020. The bill is broadly popular and widely recognized as an economic necessity, but many wonder if it goes far enough. U.S. President Biden has denounced violent attacks against Asian Americans during the coronavirus pandemic and called for an end to them.
Too often, we've turned against one another. Vicious hate crimes against Asian Americans who've been attacked, harassed, blamed, and scapegoated. At this very moment, so many of them, our fellow Americans, they're on the front lines of this pandemic trying to save lives. And still, they're forced to live in fear for their lives just walking down streets in America.
Biden made the call in a televised address to the nation. He described the attacks against Asian Americans as wrong and un-American. His comments came after weeks of outcry from the community and warnings from rights groups against the attacks. Violence against Asian Americans sharply increased last March as COVID-19 began spreading across the U.S. Last year, UN report said hate incidents against the community had reached alarming levels. It is widely believed that the anti-Asian rhetoric emerged after former President Trump blamed China for the pandemic, calling the virus the China virus. And that's it with international news.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Iran Today.
It's better for the UN to be than not to be, depending on who you ask. It's doubtful it should make any difference to the children of Yemen or Palestine, to those who've heard no whisper of human rights as they waste away in hunger from a persisting war. A key reason for the UN's failure to protect human rights is politicization, according to many human rights activists. Iran was itself a victim of this during the imposed eight-year war of the 1980s with Ba'athist Iraq. And today, the country is singly afflicted by harshest ever U.S. sanctions while sharing in the global fight with the coronavirus. Regardless, the United Nations Human Rights Council is currently holding its 46th regular session in Geneva, and it will go on until March 23, 2021. And for March the 9th, the general debate was set to be held with an interactive dialogue with the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Iran. Human rights and Iran make for a controversial combination in the eyes of the many. But those accusing Iran of human rights abuses often have themselves dark records. In any case, Iran doesn't seem to have a problem answering for itself. And we are here to see how far this country has evolved in regard to human rights and where it's headed. I'm Leila Faramazi. Human rights are a common good that contribute to human solidarity, without which it would be impossible to nurture empathy and to shield human rights from infringements and transgressions. This Esmail Baghaei Hamaneh said at last year's event. He's Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations office in Geneva. Mr. Iqbali, PhD in international law, works for the Judiciary's Research Center. As he gives us his opinion on matters, he also says a little something on his work.
Well, if we want to consider human rights in the general sense, there are examples that every human being must have by nature to be able to live a free and more prosperous life. Its examples are also different. The first generation deals with civil and political rights, the second generation is about economic, social and cultural rights, and the third generation concerns rights such as the right to development, self-determination and having a healthy environment. In fact, it's a whole unit, but at the same time, it's divided into different components.
Given how the Islamic Republic of Iran and international law seem to find themselves at odds with one another, it is easy to assume that could stem from a difference between a Western understanding of human rights and an Islamic one. Mr. Parkayin, a former ambassador of long standing, explains.
In the West, human rights are based on humanism, the originality of human beings, which became very prominent after the French Revolution. Afterwards, man replaced God. Because of the conflicts that intellectuals had with the church at the time, they replaced God with the man and said that it's the man who can give power to others. Therefore, the philosophy of humanism took shape, which gave birth to liberal democracy. According to principles of liberal democracy, human beings are free to do whatever they want, with no conditions whatsoever. In the divine religions, including Islam, people enjoy many rights, but there are limitations that are innate and are related to the specific nature of human beings and their inner characteristics.
The United Nations formation was primarily supposed to be to prevent wars and to protect human rights, but instead, big powers, particularly the U.S., use it to serve their own narrow interests. Example, America has exercised its power of veto countless times in protecting the Israeli oppression of Palestine, its illegally continued settlement building. As Hamaneh put it, the current international climate is obsessively hostile to nurturing genuine human solidarity to protect and promote the common good. Ironically, human rights are the main casualty of today's international relations. Given the international community, as we call it, is pointing a finger at Iran, what has Iran done to improve human rights matters? You must wonder what happened to our political, non-political prisoners. Iran has resolved a lot of issues, but when there's a warlike domestic atmosphere between political factions, partisanship tends to interpret everything as a security issue. Mr. Abu Torabi is on the Human Rights Committee of Parliament. He tells of how Iranian law has been amended to fit with the international expectation.
Especially now, one of the positive moves made with regards to the Constitution was the addition of political crime to it. In a recently enacted political crime, we allow a political offender to have a jury. We let the political offender, if convicted, have the right to have family visitors on a daily basis. Solitary confinement has no place anymore. We don't have solitary confinement for a political criminal. There are great achievements that most countries in the world are yet to enjoy.
In such murky waters, anyone can easily use accusation and false labels, such as spying, for instance, to gain personal advantages. In the face of foreign threats, the leader Ayatollah Khamenei has urged a unified voice among officials and people alike. Iranian authorities do not claim that Iran has been perfect in terms of human rights. That is a claim no country can make, actually. And in an effort between the three powers, laws are being amended or considered for amendment, such as laws on citizenship rights. I'll let an expert comment on that, of course.
In the Islamic Republic of Iran, the issue of individual freedom is well seen in Article 27 of the Constitution. freedom of expression and the press within the framework of the law is well enacted, and now we see how much criticism is directed at everyone, even our country's top officials, including the leader of the Islamic Revolution. As we have seen in video clips, people who visit him easily express their opinions. The same goes for the president and government officials and members of the parliament.
Over the years, Iran has tried to improve on a variety of issues. Those include prisoners' rights, the right to prohibit torture and arbitrary detention, the right to health, to education, women's rights, children's rights, the right to freedom of expression and access to information, the right to freedom of political association, trade unions and community organizations, also the right to freedom of peaceful assembly and to self-determination, the right of people with disabilities, the right to adequate housing, the rights of asylum seekers and immigrants, and of religious minorities, and freedom of belief and religion.
I'm saying this confidently, that you can't find any country in the world where all minorities are required to be represented in the parliament. In Iran, we must have one Jewish lawmaker, two Christians, and one Zoroastrian parliament member, according to their population. You do not have such a thing in France right now. Most European Muslims are in France, but they do not have laws that require one or two representatives to be Muslim. Of course, if Muslims vote and participate, they can be elected. But Iran's law requires some lawmakers to be representing the Jewish, Christians, and Zoroastrians.
As for how successful these efforts have been, we can say with confidence that regardless of the outcome, there is an ongoing rigorous debate among Iranian authorities and people about how the ideals of the revolution have not yet been reached. It is understood that more work, sacrifice, and effort lies ahead to attain the exemplary standards of social justice based on the teachings of Islam and great Iranian traditions.
The right to education is also amongst these rights. It means that governments are obliged to provide the necessary facilities for citizens to have access to an appropriate education. In the same context, the right to education has been considered in the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. For example, we can refer to Article 30 of the Constitution, which emphasizes free and public education. In this regard, we now see that in our development program, the issue of education has always been emphasized. For example, in the 12th part of the 6th development plan, there is again a section dedicated to public and higher education.
Human rights efforts and achievements of the Islamic Republic of Iran have mostly been commended by the international community in recent years. The UN Human Rights Council itself last year paid Iran a compliment in its periodic review of this country's human rights record. The preliminary debate on the report featured lengthy praise for the Islamic Republic. 95 out of 111 countries that took the floor lauded Iran for its human rights, according to UN Watch. That's a Geneva-based non-profit organization.
For example, I would like to say that now in the discussion related to the judiciary, one of the issues that should be considered is facilitating the possibility of people with disabilities to use judicial facilities. Now, whether the courtroom space is such that they can use it effectively, both in court and in the courtroom, facilities should be provided so that they are more accessible. In general, many measures have been taken. For example, if you look at the buildings of the judiciary, you will see that they're designed so that a person with a disability can move around easily. As for court appearances, there have been many cases where a person who had speech impediments or other problems was granted assistance to speak more easily and be able to defend themselves.
Iran's High Council for Human Rights said that the amendment of the law on the punishment of drug traffickers in 2017 had reduced the death penalty by 90%, and steps had been taken to strengthen the independence of judges, access to lawyers, and fair trial. There's plenty more to be said, but it's time to give other media outlets a chance. To see what they have to say, I invite you indoors. Here's what they actually say, beginning with Global Times. Washington ill-prepared to set human rights agenda. Now that Biden is in power, we are likely to hear strong rhetoric on human rights coming out of the White House and the State Department. We will observe multiple human rights-focused U.S. initiatives in international organizations. And we will also see new American human rights-related sanctions against Moscow and Beijing. Moreover, the reality is that Washington is ill-prepared to make a convincing case on human rights and broader democracy issues. First, America itself has not fully recovered from a deep and protracted political crisis. Many inside the U.S. still question the standards of November's presidential elections, as well as the legitimacy of information restrictions imposed on Donald Trump and his supporters by major social networks and the U.S. mainstream liberal media. The 2020 large-scale violent racial riots also question the assumption that the United States can serve today as a universal model of human rights observance. Until President Biden fixes related problems at home, his international human rights crusade will not look too credible, even for his fellow citizens. Iran's judiciary puts in a word on U.S. human rights, as pointed to in Ahlul Bayt. Iran's judiciary chief blasts U.S. human rights claims as power show. Today we see that the Americans who claim to be advocates of human rights are trampling on the rights of nations in just a show of power, Raisi said, addressing judiciary officials in Tehran. He added that the Americans attack the resistance centers in Syria and at the same time single out Iran for giving death penalty to drug traffickers as a human rights concern, noting that they extort money from the Saudis and claim that justice has been served, while they have not been seen to do justice so far. They violate the rights, trample on justice, and oppress the right-seeking people, but claim to be advocates of human rights, while the world people know them well and are no longer deceived, and know that Americans are violating the rights and are disloyal. Raisi had also earlier condemned Washington's systematic violation of Iranians' rights, and said the U.S. allies are the number one violators of human rights in the world. What does human rights mean to the West? The Global Times quotes, "Human rights used by West countries as tool of political manipulation," said the Chinese ambassador to the U.N. "Certain Western countries do not truly care about Xinjiang residents' lives, but simply want to use human rights as an excuse to meddle in China's internal affairs," the Chinese foreign ministry said Thursday, urging these countries to reflect on their own slaughter of indigenous people and tackle existing racism and other human rights problems. "They should reserve the hat of genocide for themselves," ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian said at a routine press conference. And that would be the news segment. Back to the narration. With a suffering economy and mismanagement, making ends meet has become backbreaking to Iranians. Albeit, China said it commends Iran's efforts to eradicate poverty, enhance social security, protect the rights of vulnerable groups, and that it hopes Iran will continue to drive economic and social development to provide a solid basis for the enjoyment of all human rights. Also, Iran's efforts to provide for refugees despite the challenges it faced and the measures to empower women, promote school enrollment, and reduce infant mortality were acknowledged.
40%
of employees in Iran are women, and more than 50% of those admitted to universities are females. More than 50% of the medical staff are women. Women in Iran are employed in all jobs. We have several women in the cabinet. We had a minister. We had a vice president. We may have laws to protect families and women, but we have difficulty enforcing them. One argument says the authorities should try to implement this, but the authorities might not always have the jurisdiction. In some cases, the implementation of the laws depends on the family members.
Syria said at the debate, "We commend Iran's active efforts to increase healthcare services by building medical care in rural and urban areas." Several speakers noted that unilateral sanctions were harmful to the promotion of human rights, especially given the ongoing need to combat COVID-19. Among those recognizing the difficulties in this fight and pledging their assistance to Iran, Russia praised this country's cooperation with human rights treaty bodies and its openness for dialogue.
We are a party to many human rights conventions, the most important of which are the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. There are two conventions in which membership brings an obligation for each country. Well, in this context, the judiciary, as one of the three branches of the country, has a duty to fulfill the obligations related to these covenants as much as possible. Our country's courts are also obliged to respect these obligations.
Developing countries are traditionally scapegoated for human rights violations. Yet, Iran became a major supporter of the Universal Periodic Review Mechanism. Hamaneh said in last year's UNHRC review session that Iran had always examined all recommendations with an open mind and a spirit of cooperation. However, certain recommendations could not be noted as they amounted to repeated allegations and biased propositions. From 1986, the UN Human Rights Council has consistently appointed a special rapporteur for Iran. But the appointment, according to Iranian officials, is not based purely on legal objectives, but on political objectives of just a few countries in the Human Rights Council.
Because international law is the product of the opinions given by all countries, it's relatively fair. But hegemonic Western countries use human rights as political tools. That is, if they have good relations with a country, if their interests are served by that country, they will not raise the issue of human rights at all. But if they want to put pressure on another country that opposes them, they will use human rights.
The Iranian Bar Association has consulted various individuals and assessed reports by the special rapporteur, Javid Rehman. Some cases had been prepared based on incorrect information and reliance on unofficial sources, and that almost all of his report was a repetition of his previous claims, which are also available on the websites of well-known opponents of the Islamic Republic of Iran who are associated with certain intelligence services. This has undermined the credibility of his report in official circles here.
Today, human rights have become a political tool in the hands of the world powers to pressure the Islamic Republic. Today, there is no such thing as democracy and ballot box in countries like Saudi Arabia. But look how they are supporting Saudi Arabia. Look how Saudi Arabia slaughtered Khashoggi with a hacksaw, but they didn't target Saudis with any punishment for it. Saudi Arabia is bombing Yemeni schools and hospitals every day in violation of all international law. They don't condemn Saudi Arabia for killing children in Yemen. That is why we say that's a double standard and that human rights have become politicized and become the political tool for the world powers.
On this matter, Ali Bagheri Kani, head of the Iranian Judiciary's High Council for Human Rights, stressed that there is no expert view on the issue of human rights in the mentioned report. In every part of the report are the views of Western powers that are in conflict with the policies and approaches of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We protest the political and discriminatory abuse of human rights mechanisms, he said. In the past, overt interference in other countries' internal affairs has been used by the U.S. as a tool to maintain its hegemonic status. Now, whatever the situation in Iran, perhaps again, this country's human rights record is about to be used by the Biden administration as a bargaining chip in getting to adapt rather than revive a troubled nuclear deal. To repeat, U.S. Secretary of State Blinken claims his government is committed to safeguarding human rights of all people because they're universal values. But Donald Trump was also a U.S. president till very recently, and it was he that withdrew the U.S. from the UN Human Rights Council in 2018, claiming that the council wasn't acting favorably enough towards Israel. And the Biden administration hasn't yet returned to the UNHR Council.
Consider those who sponsor human rights resolutions, such as Canada. Canada treats its natives the worst. Australia has a group called the Aboriginal people. These are indigenous people, as you probably know. In order for people to come and watch them as if they are in a museum, They still keep the aboriginals in a state of barbarism to earn some money. They claim to be defenders of human rights. The United States is committing crimes against people of color. Look how they burned the Davidic sect and the Europe's NATO that committed so many crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq. Europe supports the crimes of the Israeli regime against the Palestinians. They back the child-killing regime of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates.
The United States faced its first review in 5 years at the UN's main human rights body with the detentions of migrant children and the killings of unarmed black people during the Trump administration's tenure, among other issues high on minds. AP reported this in November 2020. Friendlier countries called for the U.S. to ratify various treaties aimed at guaranteeing human rights, but they expressed concerns that racial inequalities and discrimination, gun violence, and the use of the death penalty in the U.S.
Look how much human rights were violated in the case of people of color due to Trump's racist actions and support for racism. This was a heavy blow to the Western culture's identity. The same goes for Europe. This is what is happening in France, and the crimes committed by NATO as the flag bearer of peace in Afghanistan and Iraq. These all have raised questions about human rights in the West. Now, Europe and the United States have lost their identities in this regard. The basic principles of the French Revolution have now been violated.
The American Civil Liberties Union has called the government's report one of the worst attempts to cover up U.S. human rights violations since the civil rights movement in the mid-20th century. The Chinese representative Jiang Zhuan cited namely systematic racism, politicization of the COVID-19 pandemic, the proliferation of guns, and military interventions abroad that left civilians dead. Stop interfering for political reasons in other countries' internal affairs under the pretext of human rights, he said.
Iran is one of the countries that has taken the best steps with regards to freedom. It has made good progress. Look at the United States recently, or even the countries that claim to be the cradle of democracy. I cite France as an example. Look how the French police treat people. They even have discussed a law that prohibits journalists from publishing interviews with people protesting in the streets. This is why our law permits this. People are free in these matters in Iran.
Earlier in February, Ayatollah Khamenei said the domineering order has always looked for excuses against the Islamic Revolution. One day it's human rights, once vilifying theocracy, once the nuclear issue, and once regional issues. They're all excuses. The key concern is that Iran won't give in to their domination. That is for today. Thanks from the whole team. Don't forget to return to the box at the same times next week and each week after, as you never know what's going to be on. And we're waiting for your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Islam gives much importance to having good relations with kinsfolk. It requests Muslims to cling to them, for they strengthen the family and lead the community to fruitful results. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, urged the Muslims to tighten the bonds of kin. He, peace be upon him, said, "Relations with blood relatives increase acts, develop properties, repel the tribulation, make easy the reckoning, and postpone the fixed term of death."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. We are truly blessed to have you on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Now, we find that there are many dialogues in the historical texts of the Muslims. Beautiful dialogues and conversations with golden pieces of advice, which truly can help to purify and cleanse us, as well as open our inner eyes towards the realities of this world and the hereafter. In one such conversation, we find that Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, is talking with one of his companions, and he tells his companion, "On the day of judgment, a caller will call, 'Where are Al-Sabirun?' So a group of people will rise, and then a caller will call, 'Where are the Al-Mutasabirun?' Thus a group of people will rise." And so the companion asked Imam al-Baqir, "O Imam al-Baqir, who are the Al-Sabirun and who are the Al-Mutasabirun?" Imam al-Baqir replies, "The Sabirun are those who are patient with performing the religious obligations, the wajibat, and the Mutasabbirun are those who are patient with the prohibitions, the things which are haram." In this conversation, dear brothers and sisters, we see that Imam al-Baqir shows us one of the levels and one of the stations of the Day of Judgment, when a caller calls out on that day, calling for the Sabirun and the Mutasabbirun. And furthermore, Imam al-Baqir, with this knowledge given to him by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, via this divine knowledge, he tells us that the Sabirun are those who are patient when it comes to performing their wajibat, meaning they are steadfast, they are firm, they are determined to fulfill their wajibat, their religious obligations, those things which must be done. And he tells us that the mutasabirun, or the mutasabirun, are those who are patient with the things which are haram. They are religiously prohibited. And so these people, with steadfastness, with determination, with strength, with courage, they do not do those things which are haram. Beautiful pieces of advice in this interesting and very practical yet mystical conversation between this companion and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. We invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
The Imam, who was known for his famous title, Baqir Ulum al-Nabiyyin, somebody who spread the knowledge that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had given to the human society through the Anbiya and Mursaleen, which all had been given to the Prophet of Islam in addition to what was given to him. And all of that, he was commanded by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to pass it on to Ali, and from one Imam it goes to the other Imam. The era of our fifth Imam is very important to understand. When we look at the history of our Imams, the first three Imams, this is the era of survival for the Shia community. As far as Amir al-Mu'mineen is concerned, this was the struggle of establishing the truth of his claim about Imamat, Vilayat, and Khilafat. And after that, we go through this challenging period during the time of the second Imam, and then you see that things become even worse, culminating with the massacre in Karbala. But that was the worst that they could do. But they realized they cannot eliminate Ahlul Bayt or the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. And after that, things change. Even the strategy of the enemies changed, and even the focus of the Imam was now no more the issue of survival. That was already established, that this is a group and this is a mazhab which cannot be eliminated. And we have seen in the last 1400 years, in many, many places in the Muslim world, the attempt has been to eliminate the Shias, but they have always come back in larger number and with even more power and prestige. And so now the second stage, when we look at the fourth Imam's time and the fifth and the sixth Imam, this is the era of educating the community. Because the first three Imams, they did what they could do during their own time. But because, relatively speaking, the community was not still in the situation of calm and peace, they could not really sit down and go through the process of, proper process of teaching and learning. And so we see that the process started with the fourth Imam, but really took it more, organized form during the time of the fifth Imam. And that process of education and ta'aleem reached to the peak during the era of the sixth Imam.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
what you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.